it's been quite a long day, although we've still quite a long time off the schedule for finish time. But I suggest you say whatever you would like to say, Penny, and then...
No, I haven't got anything to say, really. I fear that there's a certain romantic tinge to the academic approach to anything. I'm very consciously not an academic. I think there's a fundamental problem with the idea, I don't know of any other sort of movement that is attached so thoroughly to music. I mean, I know people sort of say that music sounds a bit hippie-ish or something, but it's not hippie music, and therefore immediately box-lane, thrown into a cupboard. My own view is that the music of punk was simply the vehicle towards empowerment, and actually the empowerment is what's important, and the music was quite often unlistable crap. The people who were doing it enjoyed doing fine, and I wouldn't be critical of it, but it wasn't actually listenable by any reasonable standard. So it makes no contribution to the sort of culture of music, for example, generally speaking. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, and there are in all genres. People are actually pushing forward, the sort of development, the magnificence of the human spirit expressed through the various art forms. Well, to try and sort of coerce that into, DIY culture, which is an entirely different thing. Listening as I have all day, and I sort of see these crossover confusions, where things clearly need to be defined outside of boxes, because to my mind they've been slightly put into boxes, and the idea that punk and the punk movement are actually the same thing, I think, is a fundamental mistake, because they're not the same thing. Punk movement was about empowerment. Didn't need any music. It was an attitude in the same way. And it had its parallels in the past. Hippie before it became a sort of description of a sort of don't blade and twit. It meant something. It meant someone who's searching for value. The Bohemians, the Beatniks, back through history, there's been dissidents. And the dissidents have never, there's never been as many dissidents as there are apparent dissidents. And that was particularly the case in the punk era. Punk was talking a lot of quite complex and controversial ideas, and the average audience was probably, I can't put numbers on it, but I guarantee it certainly wasn't over 50% who actually had a real inkling of what was being spoken about in a sort of progressive sense. They might have been effective. I went to a Jesus Army thing in Battersea Park in London, and I was actually shortly after Crass had disbanded, and it was exactly the same tactics, frankly. Lots of banners, lots of big talk, get people up to sort of tell about their experiences, let's all feel like a little brotherhood. That was pure propaganda. I don't think that Crass were pure propaganda, I sincerely hope he weren't. I think there were a lot of propagandists who used some of the techniques, conflict being prime amongst those. They were propagandists, they were not people attempting to empower. My own interest was the empowerment towards whatever people found in their own life, not what they were told or instructed to look for, which is what There Is No Authority for Yourself was about. Make your own decisions, and they might be ones that I deplore, but it's the job of each individual to make those decisions. And I mean, the judgmental element of anarcho-punk became, utterly absurd. One of the biggest conflicts I ever saw was between vegetarians and vegans outside of and it was vicious and stupid. Or equally, another conflict between the Hells Angels, or the British equivalent, and the new punks at Stonehenge in 1981, was it? One of the most violent confrontations. I've never seen people being so mercilessly beaten around. Well, that's sort of sad. I don't know why I quite got into that. Why did I put it? Sorry, I'm sort of rambling, but I think.
Maybe something about the partisan element.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, exactly that. And I mean, I'm sort of looking for replication, which I rather felt, you know, it's not happening now. Well, what's not happening now? You know, what wasn't happening 30 years ago, or what was happening, you know, it just doesn't mean nothing at all to me. I have every confidence that across the globe there are people looking for new, radical, empowering ways of living, because that's human nature. Whatever the media might say, whatever we're taught in school, whatever the church might say, you know, we survive, we exist. And that will always be there, and it will always be there silently, and it will all. There's no one I've ever met when challenged who doesn't speak with spirit, heart, and soul. It might be public, you know, the expression of it might be something vile and left-wing, or it might be something vile and right-wing. But their heart's there, always. And unless we can move in, that's why I don't like confrontation with politics anymore. It's a setup. It's serving those in power. I mean, if ever there was a case of that, it was the Iraq War. It was an absolute. It needs its opposition. It can't exist without opposition, because it has set itself up in opposition. And if we haven't learned that by now, I mean, God, the 20th century should have showed us that. You know, the result of oppositional politics, from the Holocaust to fucking miners' strikes, and you name it. We have to learn new ways, and people are learning new ways. You know, the power of love is indestructible. I mean, you know, I'm not talking about personal love, I'm sure you understand. And just because we can't see it, it's sort of. In an obvious sense, we're all waiting. You know, and it's all happening anyway. I mean, Christ, the intelligence of young people. Staggering. The speed. And the sort of joy. You know, I know, okay, that's a generalization. You can see the horror stories if you want to see them. You don't want to actually engage. Every horror story is a sort of angel waiting. And if we don't see that, then we continue the horror story. I was talking to about the negativity and such. That's what happened with the punk thing. You know, we did come in with a very positive message. Find your own life, create your own life, and fuck everything else. And then after that, then the propagandists move in, the negativists. You know, who are saying, no, we can't actually manage it, because first of all, we've got to smash the police, conflicted it. And that negative is much more easily adaptable. You go home on the train tonight, and everyone's reading the negative. Everyone's stuck to the negative. Listen to the Archers, it's all negative. It's just people arguing, being nasty to each other, all the time, Coronation Street. We buy into it, because it's easier, because it doesn't require us to be good. And I really think if you're looking at sort of trajectories within the punk movement, it was that sort of bloody bigoted anarcho punk stuff which started telling people how they ought to behave, rather than saying, well, look, these things are happening. Yeah, we did that. We did point that endlessly, and we attempted to be very informative about it. And yes, we did become preachy at times, absolutely, but I don't think we started becoming judgmental and disempowering in the way that I think an awful lot of the sort of what I regard as bigots that follow us, which is why I've never been happy being labelled part of the anarcho-punk movement, because to me it was a sort of black road to bigotry and massive negativity. I'm ruling out, you know, sort of a lot of the very positive, empowering elements. But most of those positive and empowering elements came from very, very few people within that movement, so forth. And I know that's slightly against the general, you know, consensual picture, but I do believe that. Most people were hangers on, frankly. You know, most people, you know, got a living out of imitating us, not getting a living. Well, that's true. I mean, let's be honest about it. There was very little originality. What originality there was mostly came out on press records, because we were the only people willing to muck about with originality, someone like Cooper. That sort of stuff, or any anxiety, people with a fucking voice. No one bought those records, put out Conflict records and sold out by tomorrow. Biggest mistake I ever made, to ask them to do a single. Because it's set up, you know, it's almost like we gave them that, whatever, acknowledgement or whatever the word is, you know, we gave them an authenticity. Which, frankly, you know, I love Colin, he's a great guy, but Jesus, if it comes to politics or personal behaviour, you know, I can't sort of continue that. I would like the guy, that's good enough, a bit like Steve, I should remember. You know, we have massive disagreements. But anyway, I'll just go back to the beginning, I think, because I can go on. But I mean, it was just that sense of really. I've listened and I really like a lot of what I've heard, but I really am afraid of romanticising. Trying to make something out of something which wasn't really what it seems to be. I mean, I know it's been ignored by the mass media, it's been ignored by the history books. But if we're going to put the picture right, then I think it's got to be right and a little bit more, actually considerably more critical. Yeah, it's great that people are doing stuff, it's great, you know, etc., etc., etc. But it, we can't, we mustn't lose our ability to say, well, yeah, it's great, but frankly, it's crap. It's a bit like a meal, you know, anyone can cook a meal, but. And they can do it in good spirit, but then I don't think you're helping them by saying, oh, that was delicious, when actually you was inedible. It's better to say, look, if you're going to make bread, you know, etc., etc., you know, I've got some experience, can I pass it on to you? You know, and it was this sort of uncritical stance which allowed absolute banal rubbish to pass as some form of value. And I don't think that did any good for the people who were producing the banal rubbish. It didn't help them. It's just allowing them to, which is why a lot of them are still doing it today, for fuck's sake. I mean, 30 years on and they're still doing it. Well, someone should have got wise and said, hey guys, you weren't any good in the first place. What the fuck are you doing now? I mean, it's not. I don't think that's the way forward. And if you talk about a sort of dying embers. Well, that's if you look in the dying embers, you've got every reason to be exceedingly negative about, you know, radical futures. It's not there, and don't expect it to be. I mean, that pantomime was 40 years ago. And it was a great pantomime, it was fun. For all its sort of training and language, it was fun. And it certainly wasn't money, and it certainly wasn't fewer. And there weren't any
So I was about to start something, Pete.
So
I'll kind of shift the subject away slightly. One thing I noticed from some of the discussions today, it kind of touches on what Penny's saying and what you were talking about, is that I'm wary of a conflating of DIY and anarcho-punk as kind of being the same thing, that the DIY movement becomes mirrored or subsumed, actually, in some respects, in relation to anarcho. I think anarcho had a very strong correlation with DIY. But I think there were precursors in DIY, certainly in punk, prior to Crass and prior to the anarcho movement, the Desperate Bicycles, etc., there was a whole scene of DIY. And I think, like from what you were talking about, it's really interesting. But I think there's two separate things. I mean, a lot of the DIY activity wasn't necessarily anarcho; it wasn't even political. It was just political with a small p. It was do it yourself, active, but that active doesn't have to then wave a banner, carry a flag, have a political big P point of view.
I think it's certainly true. You know, one of the great things in George McKay's work is that he points out that DIY also is there in jazz or whatever, you know.
Although
I think what Penny's saying is that, you know, that if I'm understanding correctly, that we shouldn't just unproblematically applaud every DIY piece of creativity. Perhaps I'm putting
those
in the map, I don't know. But
well, I know in the case of G, who's probably one of the most mimicked artists I know of the late 20th century, you know, who just, she's appalled at the fact, I mean, if she painted a, you know, mutilated kid, A, it would be done with exquisite loving care. B, it would be put into a context that had a meaning, that had a resonance, that had poetry. Now, when she would then see other kids just sort of putting a mutilated body for no other reason than that it was a mutilated body, it might shock someone, or maybe wouldn't it? She was shocked by mutilated bodies by then, and getting used to it. It saddens G to see that form of mimicry, for Christ's sake. I mean, she wasn't putting mutilated bodies on the thing so that kids could then sort of think that was worth copying or emulating or trying to do. But so why didn't they look at how she was doing it and sort of try and think, yeah, I can actually achieve something, I can create my own pictures, like, you know. So if DIY is just actually producing poor copy, then it has no real value. And I do think we have to be pretty, and it isn't actually good enough. I mean, it's like when little kids show you some rubbish they found, and you're meant to say, oh yeah, it's lovely, Johnny, when it isn't. Johnny's put no effort into it. Johnny's not going to put any effort because he's not interested in doing a picture. He wants to be on his little keyboard or outside playing with Converse, and that patronising fucking attitude, and that's something that perhaps was certainly not as patronising. If we thought those were crap, we said so. And it doesn't help people, and I think there's an awful patronising element within the whole DIY thing, of putting up a second best.
So Mark Perry make very much the same talk, where, you know, I saw him talk a couple of years ago when he was talking about sniffing glue and then the fanzine revolution, and he said turned away from it in the end because he said actually a lot of DIY was just crap, was just not very good.
Martin McCarthy said the exact same thing about the 70s folk clubs. You see, you know, I mean, he being an incredible guitar player, who I think did appreciate novice musicianship, just as, you know, like, I appreciate a lot of novice musicianship in punk music and love it, but in other stuff, I think I don't like. So, to me, I do see what you mean, and I think it's a very good point, which actually extrapolates to DIY beyond punk. I think your hand's up first.
I've always sort of seen sort of, you know, punk or whatever, anarcho punk, whatever you want to call it, certainly UK hardcore and this rack and all this. I've always been into the here and now, you know. I'm more interested in things like, you know, burning your fingers on the white hot heat of creativity than sort of like, you know, warming them on the dying embers of the past kind of thing. But something that was kind of problematical for us, you know, me and my little friends, sat in front rooms in Manchester, was the revisiting of the Crass albums with, you know, the classical collection and things, you know, and going, well, yeah, what's, I want to know what this guy's doing now, you know. It's we've learned sort of into, like, you know, digging out your old records and, like, you know, sort of reproducing or reproducing them, if you like. Although, you know, I think efforts with the Cravats album produced, a different album, different listening experience. But it was something we did find problematical was raking up the embers of Cravats and things. What was your motivation for doing that?
Well, I mean, we had two choices. One was to just throw it all in a bin and say, finish, this is stuff we can't be seriously committed to. Or using new available technology, reproduce them to suit the current climate. In a way, as a sort of rejection of punk conformism, which is how she designed the thing. I mean, she designed them very classically, very beautifully. That's why we call it the classical collection, etc., etc. The motives was that people told us they considered what we had done to have value. I did not consider the form in which it was offered to them had any value anymore. Scrappy, badly printed. They look like sort of things in a sort of, sales bin. I remember starting thinking, a few years before we got around to doing it, going to H&M and seeing our stuff with all the other things, using expensive lettering and dead bodies on the front, fucking hell, I wanted to be out. Equally well, there's a lot I disagree with about some of the politics in our albums now, because it's 30 years old, but I do believe what they had to say had broad meaning and value. So I wanted to put them out again in a way I'd be proud of, put something, rather ashamed of.
And there were two questions chalked up, Gordon, so I think you wanted to say something.
It was more an observation that I agree in the sense of the. One of the turnoffs, especially the last 30 or 40 years, was kind of shifted production technology, so they had a lot more bands to release records. And what was happening with a lot of those bands was quality, like bullshitty technical in the sense. They were going out, a lot of it was going out the window, it was just having a go. And that was a big turnoff in a way, because I actually went from either recorded a demo with the band or put a set in chat, there was a hell of a lot of effort into that. And it seemed an attention to detail. And as that shifted, more accessibility, it was almost like stuff was getting thrown out there. I'm not going to be specific, but it was a big turn-up. And I think the shift towards bands now are moving towards vinyl again and doing that in that way. I think it's really exciting.
Are you talking about the Bullshit Detector album?
No, I'm talking about the last decade, but same the similarities to the Bullshit Detector, where you say, look, anyone does it, send your tapes and we'll put it out. But I'm saying that also happened, with the idea of CDs and being able to pull records out. And it was just, I was sent review copies from various scenes, and it was just, the stuff was just, quality control, just more important, let's get in the studio and make this thing.
It's a sort of matter of finding what sort of level of culture one is sort of trying to look at. I mean, I tend to be, I'm an elitist in the sense of grand culture. I do believe in art, I believe in the value of grand art, the grand narrative within art, whether that's music or poetry or whatever, opera, jazz, any form. And I think punk briefly touched on that, some of it, classic and wonderful acts of grand culture. I think Pistols even might start, with some of the trunk. At another level, you have sort of like folk cultures, which is where I would imagine DIY rather belongs. In folk culture, you can produce crap bread because that's what you might enjoy. It's going to be, when I say crap, maybe it's going to be all gritty, but that's the sort of wind you have, whatever. It's going to reflect your conditions, your being, in a very positive and real way, which is what folk music, good folk music, manages to do, doesn't it? Folk music starts having pretensions about being grand culture. It sounds fucking awful. I mean, any attempt to lift folk out of where it belongs is a sort of, It ceases to be. It's a bit, actually, jazz is rather similar. Put jazz in a concert form and it becomes a total joke. It needs to be close and instinctual. So I think, again, you know, it's too easy to talk about culture, you know, without actually defining where you're coming in on it. And, you know, and I'm saying this partly because I sort of feel I've been heavily dissing DIY, and I don't, you know, I mean, I put DIY instead of, I mean, Barrel House is the product of DIY, everything I still do is DIY. But that's on a sort of, that's on a folk level. That's the chicken coop I've just built, or the compost bin I've just cleaned, and all that sort of stuff, the nice food I've made. And then there's the other aspiration. And that's a challenging, big aspiration. And I think it's a shame that people, you know, in our culture are beginning to say, oh no, I don't really want to go into that, that's elitist. Well, I don't think Benjamin Britten was an elitist when he was, you know, and he never became an elitist. He was taken on by GMB, and God knows why, because he was highly critical at every point, you know, in terms of sort of radical gayness. He was way ahead of the book, etc., etc., you know, and I think there's a danger within, you know, as an off-growth from the sort of whole punk DIY thing, to sort of not actually look to the great voices that have actually made the world the place where these other things can exist. These things couldn't have happened without Nietzsche, they couldn't have happened without Brahms, they couldn't, etc., etc. And we still, sadly, maybe need our Nietzsches and our Brahms and our Sartres and all the rest of it, because we're not actually strong enough ourselves to go it on our own.
It's just the same, though, with the Crest Records and the back catalogue, your production is as much a part of that as the band. There's a distinct sense, or I get a sense of it, wanting control, that I mean, George Berger talked about this, that you would put pressure on musicians to get things right. It's a case of downs, you know, because you can't really essentially. But that's what I'm trying to say, that there was a lot of effort and time
for
the production and the general aesthetic of Crass, which is overlooked.
What you're saying is there's a need for a sort of critical dimension and not an unproblematic anything.
Yeah.
I wonder what your take is on that, Sarah.
I can't listen to too much 80s stuff anymore, but I think it evolves, you know, I see it as evolving, and I think by the 90s people were taking all this musically, and stuff like The X and Dawson and people like that, who were fantastic musicians, really experimental, still sort of political, but, you know, exciting to listen to as well, you know, it was just do, the skipping and drumming and shouting. The catalyst in the 80s might not have been the best quality always, but people grow up and evolve, and I think all bands should split after 5 years or something. You know, they keep doing stuff. I suppose I'm an artist, they go, you know, there's different phases of development rather than, don't get many artists that do the same thing for 15 years, or however. So, but the same with bands, or musicians, just keep, and don't be contained by music either, it's not just music, is it? It's other things you do in your life, it's how you, you know, it's living with integrity and a bit of compassion and all the rest of it.
I wonder whether the whole punk movement thing become sort of an attractive thing because, quite simply, because we all might have been there. Do you know what I mean? It was possible anyone could fit into that one. You know, it might be but slightly more difficult to take up a sort of slightly more difficult narrative to sort of engage with, you know, sort of say existentialism in Paris in the 40s, you know, it actually requires quite a big deal of effort. You can't DIY existentialism. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? And I wonder whether we sort of like, it's a sort of like quite a convenient place to get stuck in, because actually the standards are so appallingly low that it's not very difficult. You understand? I'm not being sort of crappy here. I'm sort of trying to say, well, why is punk above them all, become a thing?
it's the original dumbing down, because the Ramones deliberately said, look at us, how dumb we are, while secretly being kind of quite clever at times. Very secretly. But I I'm not the only one who's desperate for a pint, but I can see I know you've been waiting for ages to say something.
Maybe I thought I was about to change topic, and now I feel I'm not. Because I think I could probably agree with the artistic quality of France, and that maybe, you know, some of the mimicry, or maybe all of it, doesn't have that. But if we're trying to understand it as something else, I would like to more return to that anarcho part of anarcho-punk that this day started off with. And the paper that was speaking about pacifism or not, anti-militarism, but one thing that is so much there through all, you know, good and bad, is war from this, you know, from this point in time. And even, you know, badly reproduced mutilated bodies was, you know, saying something about you know, how people saw their position and so on. And I think that punk is interesting, for anarcho-punk is interesting, because it questions the state, really questions the state. And I think when you were talking about what's happening now, I mean, war is here maybe more than it was then, but then we saw strong states representing war and being repression, and of course we've got strong states now, but they're also turning against states that are not functioning states, and the state has been undermined by so many other processes. Of course, it's still, you know, powerful and all that, but I think that we should see punk also as telling us something very interesting about power in the 70s and 80s and maybe also 90s and what was happening there. And I think punk is interesting to study just because of that, also, regardless of the artistic quality.
Yeah, but we don't... I'm not actually convinced by that, because, you know, this, you know, without being vain or anything, this was intelligent in the sense that it acknowledges a source, you know, which was Crass, you know, of that term about. And it wouldn't have happened without us. Maybe someone else might have come up, but I, you know, the Poison Girls are possibly the only people who I met in all of that time who might have come up with some sort of equivalent, but they wouldn't have, it wouldn't have worked because it's coming from a very different angle. You know, and I actually, that's why I was talking about it. I'm not proud of this or anything. I'm just saying this is a fact. You know, your people are trying to put the record straight, you know, like as academics. I mean, I went to the first academic conference in the year 2000, and that was Caroline Coon talking about going to bed with Paul Simonon or someone, or and then some other twat accusing me of wearing a suit, so he went to Oxfam. I mean, it was just so fucking weird. And not one mention. I think you were there, and I missed yours, and I think you were the one mention of anything apart from the history book thing happened. Yeah. Well, I missed yours, and it was the only one I didn't. And I had choices. But I actually think it's... If a movement, I mean, it's a bit like sort of saying all Germans were Nazis in the 30s and 40s. They weren't, you know, there were signed up members, and an awful lot of people who didn't know how to behave, a lot of people who went along with it, and quite a lot of people who didn't, etc., etc. But the idea that all people were Nazis is crap. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, like this, to what extent is this whole movement a sort of invention? I mean, what's real in that movement? I mean, I'm going to ask you, what do you think is real within what we like, what this today has been defined as the anarcho-punk movement? What's real about it?
It's such a community, I suppose. Networking and things like that that enable you, that empower you to do things without having to go and capture hands and not being in business. Enables you to do things that you couldn't do otherwise.
So the network.
Well, you gave the example of the lesbian girl in a village who wrote to you.
Yeah.
That's real.
Yeah.
So probably
I just don't understand why you're being so negative about it. I mean,
I'm not being negative. I'm trying to ask questions. I'm trying. I've sat and listened to something which I think
you kind of dissed hangers on, but hangers on become people, or some of them become people who are active in doing the rest of things.
Yes,
the imitators, but the imitators learn through the imitation to carry on and maybe do.
There's no question in my mind that what was inspired, I mean, most of the people I've met who've been through all of that have become highly creative in their lives, whether that's a terrific lot of them working in some form of social service, for a start, or creative life generally, a lot of them in media, blah, 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 blah. So I'm not being negative. What I'm questioning is, you know, because this is meant to be an academic conference, I'm trying to engage on that level and say, well, are we looking at the right sort of questions? You know, what? I'm being a devil's advocate in places because I think it's too easy. You know, like if the first, you know, when I went in the year 2000 to that thing, that was one story. And I just sensed a very slight danger in what I've heard this evening of creating another equally romantic and slightly inaccurate story, which wasn't really looking at the truth. Well, hasn't found the truth in what it's looking at, which is a better way of putting it.
I appreciate you asking difficult theoretical questions, and I agree it isn't a good place to do it here, absolutely. So, Jim, you...
Yeah, I want to listen to DIY quality control. I appreciate the stuff that Roger said about attention to detail and like the idea of, you know, encouraging people where maybe things could be improved. But I really am wary and dislike the idea of somebody or anything happening that's this quality control and their opinion should matter more than somebody else's. You know, so it's all entirely subjective and whatever else. But I don't know if framing that in saying that elitist stuff is good. I mean, generally that you can appreciate it's artistic merit and all the rest, but a lot of the time it can be very closed off, and you don't have, you talk about demystification of the production processes, which I think is totally central to what happened in punk. If you get a bit too glossy, then the processes disappear behind that, and then suddenly it's a bit rough and ready and say, oh yeah, no, I can see how this works and develop onwards. So, I think there's a lot to be said for populism. Very, you know, you call it folk culture or whatever, but I think populism is where the kind of anarchic roots are, as opposed to elitism. And, you know, populism can be co-opted into elitism later on. Maybe that's what's happened with previous things, but, you know, I appreciate the points about attention to detail and encouraging things to be better, but I'm really wary of people having control.
Elitism or expertise doesn't necessarily mean control. It's got nothing to do with it. It's about wisdom, about experience. I mean, I know precisely what I can do in the studio. Someone asked me to do a production for them, I can say, yeah, this is where I'm good. If you want another form of production, go to youth or someone like that, who's fucking brilliant in another field. You make your choices of people who do the job well. I'm not going to ask a bread maker to, you know, lay a pavement for me. You know, people have got skills. That's another thing about that sort of, you know, that sort of Marxist thing, oh, yeah, well, we're all equal. It's crap, we're not. We've all got skills. We don't recognise them. We don't celebrate them anymore. We're too embarrassed to fucking celebrate them. I'm fucking brilliant at making bread. You can get away with that. I'll have a job now saying, I'm a fucking brilliant poet and philosopher as well. Oh, no, I shouldn't really say that. You know, someone might judge it. And actually, they will like the bread, but maybe not the philosopher. You know, we've become so... If we're going to talk about empowerment, and that is what punk was about, well, let's fucking empower ourselves and not disempower each other. You've got skills, you've got talents, well fucking celebrate them and allow me to by telling me what they are rather than saying, oh no, I'm just like you.
Rocky Smith.
I'm not saying you're doing that.
No. Rocky Smith said in a fanzine interview in about 1980-ish that I picked up somewhere on the line, crass have the attitude that every bloke in the street is a great bloke, which is a load of old crap, which is ironic, it seems to me, because you actually hold the opposite view, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, though. But I know you really wanted to speak. I think we should start to tail things off soonish.
But the DIY, I mean, I don't think it doesn't get one has to be good at everything, though, does it? Some people might specialise, like music in production, or other people in distribution, other people in
Is it not a bit of a counterbalance argument, this? Basically, if the opposite of elitism is... What is the opposite of elitism? Presumably it's that we would never make a comment on anyone else's work. I wouldn't want that for the musical activity that I do.
Populism is encouraging things, and, okay, some things are shit, but I don't think we should be left out of being exposed to whatever.
I think we're getting into regimes, areas of discussion that are beyond our ken right now, although
It was just picking up on what Penny was saying about this idea or the danger of over-romanticising something, and history has a habit of doing that when we look back reflectively. When you pose the question of what did anarcho-punk or punk mean to people, I think it opened up for some a sense of possibilities, but no differently than the 60s counterculture opened up a sense of possibilities, no differently than rock and roll opened up a sense of possibilities. So I don't think any of these particular movements, I don't like using that word movements, is any different in the fact that what it did for a generation of people at a particular time was open up a sense of possibility.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't over-romanticise one thing over another, because they all effectively did the same thing at different times for different groups of people.
But are the Teddy Boy academics?
I couldn't tell you. I'm sure there will be. I'm sure there will be. I think every subcultural group has been studied. And
there's a conference coming up in a couple of weeks at Keele University about subculture, and there's people talking about Teddy Boys and skins. So that is definitely an area of research. You want to see it, so
yeah, I just want to say, I'm not an academic, but this is debate that seems to be the first part of the sort of politics. They were actually all to the music. And I think there's a couple of things going on that has been sort of ended sort of things to do with libertarianism and anarchism and fits on the battle. And at the power of and so forth, which is across many, just universal thing to human nature. But it's also to do with the punk music as a form. Today is very much about looking at the legacy like in a historical way. I sort of think there's a sort of slight contradiction between the two, a slight danger of us packaging punk as a piece of music and era and appearing. That's slightly obviously the libertarian thing and it isn't in a wider sense. So I'm keeping up on maybe the conflict going on there, but to do with something like
yeah, but we didn't really programmed it when we discussed it to say, oh, you had the first two papers fit together because fit together in the afternoon, it's more like the music, culture, and art, graphics, and things. So it was consciously divided in that way. And yes, there are those contradictions, I think, at the heart of not only discussing anarcho punk, but discussing musical politics. So, you know, yes, there is a huge tension there. Sorry, I'm kind of taking advantage of answering that one, but I just feel like we're getting to the point that we should try and round off if you want to say something.
Yeah, I was very interested in Penny's comment about sort of high and low culture, and that as a society we're kind of shy of high culture, much in Britain, you know. But one of the interesting things about punk was finding the beauty in ugliness, which is sort of follows on a tradition of the French poetry of Baudelaire and Rambo, especially. I think you just sort of highlighted a paradox there that, you know, we're following on from that tradition, but hey, they were really good poets as well.
But isn't there a problem when we start distinguishing between low and high culture that we've reinforced in the structure of power?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, your balladeers and your folk players, they can't go and play in an Octagon opera house, for instance. They're going to have to be down the pub or even a Penny Black's and assembled crowd. But is there really a distinction, or rather, should we really distinguish between the two, instead of that has more cultural value and that has less cultural value?
I wouldn't say one had more or less. I would say they're different. And I think they are different. And I'm not making any value judgments or anything. I mean, low high sounds like it's some sort of value judgment. It isn't, of course it isn't. And that's just the common term, isn't it, for cultures. You know, I actually believe I belong more in the low culture in the sense of my interest. So I don't know, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to just put that out and tell you about, you know, what did it mean to Sarah? And I think for me and for people I hung around with, it's very much a spur to do things. And I think the people that I mess around with, not that we achieve or anything like that, but we probably spend more time being a nuisance outside the musical arena than it is in the musical arena and just going out and doing things. I think that's what it was.
I suppose
again, there's another. I mean, that was that's an old motivation. You know, that it was cheap, it was easy. Mm.
Yeah, I suppose I worry a lot about loss of aspiration. You know, I think all great art, you know, and that's another story altogether, etc. But you know, it's about aspiration. You know, it's about the impossible. And in a strange way, the sort of cozy, oh yeah, well, we can do it all ourselves, you know, culture, with which I've been a great part, can be non-aspirational because it's all being done, put simply. You know, we can do it, so we don't actually have to push and fight and struggle. You know, I'm not a great one on angst, but actually it's a sort of big, it can be a big help. You know, I don't think it's any great surprise that, you know, so much great art has come from great forms of poverty. Because it's a struggle, you know, and it's being recognised in the visible, you know, in that way. So if we create comfort zones, we have to be so careful not to allow them to become exactly that and actually just be poor replicas of sort of bourgeois system. You know, that's one of the things I've struggled with at Dark House. It's an open house all the time it's been there, that to remain a radical space to be with them has actually required, you know, this rejection of certain other comforts which, you know, might make it easier to live there or nicer to live there, whatever it is. Because I do fear that, you know, these sort of, if we sort it out, then there's a sort of complacency can set in. I mean, I don't feel that, I don't suffer from that, but I have observed it. Oh, this is right. It's like, you know, the family goes on holiday, lie down the beach, and they say, well, this is the life. But if it's the life, why aren't they living it? you know, it's sort of like that sort of contradiction. And we do it ourselves, you know, we're not aware of ourselves doing it with our own complacency. I do it myself, I'm not aware of doing it with my complacency, sorry, I should not say that. You know, I'm very aware of that. And that's why I set myself the grand picture of elitism. Yeah, I want to be a fucking Nietzsche or a Jean-Paul Sartre or a Rambo or Baudelaire. I don't want to be Penny Rambo of Press, I'm bored with that, I've done that one. It wasn't enough. There's more to come.
I think that's probably because we invited Jenny to stop. I've made the mistake this morning
of thinking
go on very quickly now. So
that's
a good point. Talk about that in a second, but I made the mistake in the taxi of saying, of course, Penny's the only one in the room, or the taxi as it was, who's met John Lennon, which is nothing really compared to the fact, Penny, that you caused questions to be asked in their house, or you know, with your comrades, Manning Thatcher, and embarrassed her. Bravo to that, I think everyone here.
But I make bloody good bread.
Thank you very much for coming today. Thank you very much to Sarah and to everybody who's spoken. I think it's been